Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest today is quite simply one of the greatest basketball players of all time, Earl Monroe, a man who rose from the rough streets of South Philadelphia to the Hall of Fame in nearby Springfield. But as it would so often throughout his life, his prowess in hoops allowed the Pearl to advance, first to college hoops for Winston-Salem State University, where he averaged an astounding 41.5 points per game his senior year, and then to the pros, where he was named Rookie of the Year for Baltimore. He would eventually be traded to New York, where he teamed with Walt Frazier in the backcourt to form the flashy backbone of what would prove to be the Knicks' last championship team in 1973. Monroe's accolades are long. His number was retired by both franchises, he was a four-time All-Star, and he was named to the Basketball Bible, that is, the NBA's Top 50 Players list. Current Knicks fans might enjoy the showmanship of J.R. Smith or the sweet shot of Carmelo Anthony. Monroe had both down more than four decades ago. But his life has also had its ups and downs, both before and after his 1980 retirement, including brushes with racism and a complicated family life. Earl Monroe's new memoir is Earl the Pearl, My Story, published by Rodale, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. You've done the whole book. Oh, gosh. But it sounds so good coming from you because, you know, sometimes when you do things, you know, you don't look at it the same way. And I think you introduced it very well.
Well, thank you. Did you enjoy the process of looking back? I mean, there's a lot of pain in this book. So was it difficult for you to look back at where you came from?
Yes, it was. You know, I'm not one of those people that do a lot of reminiscing and things of that nature. And when we started the process, you know, there were things that, you know, in places that I went that I wasn't very comfortable with. But, you know, this was an attempt for me to let people know who I am, where I came from, and so forth and so on. Because, you know, so many people know of Earl Monroe, but they don't know of where I come from, anything about me. And hopefully they'll get an idea of who I am and how I got to be who I am today.
When did you realize what basketball could do for you?
Well, you know, in playing, I never really thought of it in terms of what it could do for me. I just enjoyed playing it. And in as I played it, you know, I got to a point where as I start to understand that, you know, it was entertaining for me. And in turn for being entertaining for me, I saw in the stands that it was also entertaining for, you know, the spectators looking at it. And that was early on. And it wasn't so much of me, you know, playing to the crowd. My natural game was such that it was very entertaining.
People have talked about your style being sort of jazzy on the court. And in the era you grew up, NCAA wasn't on TV all the time. The NBA didn't have five games a night that you could watch. So how did you learn to play the way you did?
Well, actually through trial and error, because I really didn't start playing basketball until I was 14. And I was walking down the hall in junior high school, and the coach of the basketball team asked me if I played basketball. I guess because I was 6'3" then and like a string bean. And I said, no, sir. He asked me to come down to the gymnasium that afternoon, and I fell in love with the game. However, I wasn't very good, and I wasn't very good for a long time. People started to, you know, make fun of me, laugh at me, and so forth and so on. I went home one day, and I told my mother what was going on and how people were ridiculing me. And she told me to stop whining and take this notebook and write those people's names down that were doing all this laughing and joking and whatnot about me. And as I got better, to scratch their names off. And that's what I did. And it gave me a sense of confidence as I was scratching the names off, and also gave me a great sense of satisfaction because, you know, it seems as though, and I don't know if she meant it to be that way, is that I really had a goal to shoot for. And as I got better and better and better, you know, it just made everything, you know, just really satisfying for me.
And it led to you going to North Carolina to Winston-Salem to go play in college. What was it like when you first arrived there?
Well, when I first arrived, you know, I wasn't recruited per se. There was a guy who had gone to Winston-Salem. And back in those days, especially in the black colleges, guys who played for the coaches, they were the scouts when they went back home. And a guy by the name of Leon Whitley saw me play and asked me if I would go to Winston-Salem. I had never heard of Winston-Salem and certainly hadn't been down south at any point in my life. So I said no. And the only images I had seen about being down south were the images that I saw on TV, and they weren't very good. So I decided that I was going to go to Temple Prep to prepare to go to maybe a major school. And we played against the Big Five schools in Philadelphia, Villanova, Temple, Penn, LaSalle, St. Joe. And back in those days, freshmen couldn't play varsity basketball. So the prep schools played all these freshman teams. And what I found as I was playing these freshman teams that I was really better than all those guys that were on those teams. So I for some reason, I dropped out of school then. And when Whitley came to talk to me and I refused him, I went on to work in a knitting mill. And after four months of working in the knitting mill, he came back. I was ready to go to school. And I said, yeah, I'll go down to Winston-Salem if my friend could go with me. And he came back and said that was okay. We could both go down. However, we didn't have scholarships or anything like that. So essentially, we went to school not seeing the coach before, not talking to the coach, and we basically had to try out in order to stay in school.
Which, of course, you did. And I just kind of wondered, you know, it's the 1960s, it's the South at that point. As you mentioned, the images weren't good, and they've remained that way for many people in their memories as they talk about this era. You did face some racism, but ultimately it seems like, you know, when people saw you play, that maybe helped a little bit as far as the way you were treated.
Basketball, just like music or whatnot, seems to transcend its to, you know, racism to a point. However, you know, that I had some run-ins with the Ku Klux Klan and, when I was going to Virginia to visit a girlfriend and found myself in the midst of a Ku Klux Klan rally, and they chased me for a number of blocks in a car, and I was able to finally get away and, you know, get someplace that was safe. But, you know, interestingly enough, our team at Winston-Salem State Rams was responsible in a large part for keeping the tensions down, you know, racial tensions down in that area. More and more people, as we won 31 games, I think 31-1 overall. And the more that, you know, we won and the more I was scoring, the more people came out. And when it used to be all a black crowd to see us, there were more whites that came to see us. And, you know, more than ever before, you know, whites and blacks were sitting together. And it was a great scene. And, you know, and we flourished in that scene. And I'm just happy to have been down there during that time because of all the places that in the South that were erupting with racism and whatnot. Ours was relatively calm.
You know, there's so much to ask you about. I want to jump ahead a little bit, and on this theme of respect, you write a lot about what it means to have won the NBA championship. So many players nowadays, you know, you talk about how many championships is LeBron going to win? How does he stack up against Michael Jordan? This is a big talk when Jordan just turned 50. For me, I was the right age to have my heart broken by the Houston Rockets beating the Knicks in seven games and never seeing Ewing and Starks and that crew, Oakley, get that championship ring. Here it is, 40 years later since that Knicks championship. You guys are still the last team to have done it. How important is the ring to the players who play the game? Because certainly it's important for fans.
Well, I think, you know, obviously there have been a lot of great players who, you know, weren't able to taste the champagne of winning, you know, the championship. But, you know, for those of us who have, I mean, it more or less verifies your career. And we're seen in a different light. I mean, when you think in terms of what Russell has done with all his rings and now, you know, even what Phil Jackson has done with all his rings, they've been tasting a lot of champagne. They should be drunk by now. But just getting a sip of it, you know, like I did, the one championship was, you know, kind of verified my career and certainly put us with a certain status here in New York having been a part of that team, which was such a great, great team. You know, we had two Rhodes Scholars on that team with Bill Bradley and Jerry Lucas. We had Dave DeBuscher, who was also a coach in the league before playing with the Knicks. We had Willis Reed, who, you know, was the captain who had come out to probably the biggest sports pitcher ever when he came out of the tunnel in 69-70 championship against the Lakers, limping and hitting the first two shots of the game. Then we had, you know, Walt Frazier. What can you say? That's Clyde. You know, he did it all. And, you know, and myself, we had like six Hall of Famers on that team and a Hall of Fame coach in Red Holtzman. And, you know, it was a very, very special team. And I did mention Phil Jackson came in off the bench and did a yeoman's job as well.
Artist, showman, magician. He was all of these and so much more. And in 1973, finally a champion. In all the game's history, no pearl has ever shined brighter. Number 15, Earl the Pearl Monroe.
You know, the thing in a nutshell about that team is, you know, it was a very intelligent team, very smart team. But the team had great chemistry. You know, we all loved each other for the most part. And, you know, and today, coming back after 40 years, the first time that we've all been together, only Dave DeBuscher wasn't here because he passed away, we were still doing the same little things we were doing back in the day. You know, as I made the speech for the team, you know, at the Garden, and as I'm walking by, you know, I hear you only have a minute and a half, and it's Phil Jackson with a stopwatch. And as I'm speaking, you know, and I look over at him, and he's saying to me, you've got 25 seconds left, you know. So, you know, the same nuances that we had back in those days, it just lets you know that good people don't change.
When you were traded to the Knicks, there was some question as to how you might gel with a team that had won the year before you got there and how the backcourt might work with, you know, sort of playing styles between you and Frazier. How easy or hard was it to transition to, you know, joining the Knicks from Baltimore?
Well, it was difficult initially, but, you know, the metamorphosis from coming to, you know, New York, you know, was like a drama in itself because I had stopped playing for the Bullets and forced them to trade me. But New York wasn't the, you know, team I wanted to go to. I gave them three teams that I wanted to go to, which were L.A., Chicago, and Philadelphia, which is where I'm from. And when I got word that New York wanted to sign me, I had to think about it for a few days. So I was actually out in Indiana at that time. And I came back to Philadelphia and spent a couple of days with my mother and sister, and finally my good friend Sonny Hill decided that, yeah, you know, okay, I'm going to try and make this happen. One of the things that I found is that, you know, and said to myself, all those individual goals that I wanted to have, you know, that I set when I first got into the league, I wasn't going to be able to achieve. But I think going to a team like this that's established, that's a winning team, a great organization, and playing alongside of Clyde, I think we'll make a good team.
Who do you most enjoy watching in today's league?
Well, LeBron is the first guy. I mean, he's such a load, as they say, you know, a combination of finesse and power, and understands the game, you know, very, very well, which is, you know, really makes him, you know, a lot different from a lot of players because a lot of players just play the game. LeBron understands the game. He's more or less, you know, he's a shooter. He's a scorer, let me say that. But at the same time, he's a pass-first scorer. So he could be a point guard, and what he's playing basically is point forward. You know, he's a very dynamic player who imposes his will on the game itself. You know, Kobe Bryant, you know, is the same type of player. Kobe now, you know, has gotten up in years, so to speak. When you say 34, 35.
Yeah, at least for the NBA.
Now, Right, you know, they say, wow, he's up in years. But he's been in the league a long time. There are a lot of guys, Chris Paul, you know, as a point guard, Kevin Durant. You know, there are a lot of guys that really play this game and play it well. And it's a pleasure to see it because the game itself is moving along at rapid pace.
Do you, members of the 73 championship team, hunger for a Knicks championship, or is it something like that Miami Dolphins thing that happens every year where, you know, the last team loses a football game, doesn't go undefeated, and they sort of pop a champagne bottle? Because, you know, I think it would mean a lot for the city, but then again, it is kind of cool that it's still you guys who pulled it off.
Yeah, you know, I laugh because I know Larry Little, who is on that Miami team, and I see him all the time, and he talks about the fact that, you know, they do pop that champagne. But, you know, I would like to see them win another championship. And I don't think it would detract from us at all. I think that the name of the game is championships, and certainly these people here in New York, you know, have starved for a long, long time in terms of winning a championship, and I think they deserve it.
We've been speaking with Earl the Pearl Monroe. He's the author of Earl the Pearl, My Story, published by Rodale. It's been a real honor to speak with you. Thank you for taking a few minutes for us.
Okay, thank you much, man. I appreciate it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.